Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy, who's still replacing Stephanie Collins. We record on Wednesday morning, and I saw an article at the American Prospect. And normally I've been starting by talking about Project 2025, but we will not need to do that today because the author of the piece that I've been dissecting is actually going to be joining us as our first guest. But I wanted to share this opening salvo from this article because never have I seen a magazine provide so much print real estate to a interview with a young reporter who is devastated by what they are covering and whether they can still stay in journalism. And it's not a function of money. It's a function of what he is asked to do. So I am going to read you the headline, and then I'm going to read the opening paragraphs. Fascist state. There are degrees of political insanity. After its recent Republican primary elections, Texas approaches a psychotic break. Right? That's the title. That's the title. And here's how Rick Perlstein frames it. I made a friend a few years ago, a young journalist at a newspaper in a smaller Texas city, bored with his work and seeking out conversations on the kind of things I write about. As time went on, however, he just wanted to talk about escape. Quote, a local city I cover, as a matter of habit, appeals every single public records request, close quote. Went to typical plaint, quote, in a state that hasn't completely lost its mind, maybe the solution is to reach out to the AG's office. Except in Texas, you're trying to get an indicted man who covers, as a matter of habit, appeals every single public record request, close quote. Went to typical plaint. And again, he goes on, I can't reach out to him. Why? In a state that hasn't completely lost its mind, maybe the solution is to reach out to that AG. But once again, let me remind you, this is the same AG who helped with the January 6th Act. And what did he do? He basically wanted to support it on behalf of what he claims was the public. At the end of that year, he approached me on the horns of a dilemma. Should he take a job as a beat reporter at another daily in a big Texas city, or quit journalism and find some job as a do-gooder nonprofit? The guy's dog's name is Molly Ivins. I told him, I love that. I told him I didn't think he had much choice. Alas, he took this graybeard's advice. Things since have been hardly more rewarding. One day, working on a deep dive into how the state of Texas fails to protect intellectually disabled people from predatory guardians, depressing stuff. Another day, a thing that really irks me about covering conservative dust-ups is how profoundly dishonest the whole thing is. When it comes to right, you have two options. Either cut through the BS and call it what it is. Then they'll tell you you're biased. Or you can try to finesse it. And then what? You sound insane. Here's another comment. I also just finished a story about how domestic violence homicides are through the roof in Texas, even as overall homicide rates have declined. But we don't have the infrastructure to really know how bad conditions have become. It turns out when you turn women into second-class citizens and make guns easily accessible, that doesn't go well. A couple of weeks back, he shared with me a dark epiphany. He no longer felt hope, thought it might be high time to get the hell out of his native state forever. He asked if there was anything out there that would give me hope. Having reached the forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown stage of my relationship with the United States, in part thanks to his testimony from the front lines, I had no comfort to offer. But I did say, you know what? Let's do a Q&A. Let's just talk about it. And that's exactly what he posted at the American Prospect. Oh my God, I have no hope. And with that, now I get to move to an either equally depressing conversation with a remarkable writer. The title of the piece at the Washington Spectator was Project 2025, The Latest Plot Against America. Ann Nelson is the author of Shadow Network, Money Media, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. She is the recipient of the Livingston Award for Journalism and a Guggenheim Fellowship for Historical Research. She wrote this amazing, amazing piece at the Washington Spectator. I interviewed you, Ann Nelson, a couple of weeks ago, and I said, you got to come on all the time. One, we could hardly get through your piece because there's so much in it. But of course, what you were trying to do was take a 900-page tome and then turn it into an article that wouldn't be 899 pages long, which I totally understand. But one, my conversation with you was just inspiring and made me realize I've been talking about Project 2025, but I need to do it on a more regular basis. So one, I'm grateful that you're here to join me to talk in more depth about your piece. And even I want you to mention what happened the other day at the event at Yale. Please do that. But what my audience knows is I am been taking your article, which is so in-depth and comprehensive, and I've been taking literally sections of it out. And every single day for like five of the last 7 or 8 days, I begin my show by reading a piece from your article. All right, I call it installment one, installment two, installment three, because I feel like we need to beat the drum. We need to give people repetition. They need to understand the depth and extent of what they are doing. And more importantly, Anne, you and I both know, this is not only about the November 2024 election. It is already happening in states across the country. So you already see the infrastructure happening in Iowa, in Oklahoma, in Texas, in Florida. And they don't even need Donald Trump to get elected to accomplish so much of what they want to do. And that, to me, everyone, is so important. One, because it means states frickin' matter. All right. You need to see what's going on. And I mean, from the school board all the way up to the Supreme Court justice you might elect. Look at Arizona. But I'm just talking about the fact. So I want to welcome you back to the program. But I want you to sort of remind my audience a little bit about this incredible 900-page Heritage Foundation document. But as you describe it in a sentence or two, tell my audience what just happened the other day at Yale. Because I think the event is something I was very well aware of. I knew a lot of people that were there. Reverend Barber was there. John Nichols was there. My good friend Robert Hennelly was there. Apparently you were there. So they brought in journalists from around the country, but they also brought in a lot of Black political activists as well from around the country. And you shared something with me before we started taping, and I want you absolutely to tell this story because I want to trigger people to realize you're not alone in not knowing. But you have no excuse now if you listen at least to my show and you read what Anne writes and you go to events like Anne goes to, because this is a document that already warns you about what's happening, but you need to take it seriously. So welcome back to the program, Ms. Nelson, and describe for my audience a little bit about your article. But more importantly, if you had to describe Project 2025, it is not just a plot against America. It is a literal detailed GPS graphic sort of display of every single component of government that will be dismantled.
It is a blueprint.
Yeah.
It is paint by number, right? So it's not like these fuzzy ideas of, oh, we'd like a theocracy. It's like the devil's in the details and all the details are laid out. And just so your audience isn't too put off, I did boil down the main points, or 10 main points to know, in a matter of 3 or 4 pages. I tried to make it, you know, break it down into bite-sized chunks.
Right.
And I also tried to make it organized according to people's central concerns. You care about the environment and energy? Here's environment and energy. You care about children and public health? Here is what they're doing there. I believe strongly that when they put this out, you know, a few months ago, they buried these points in the 900 pages specifically so people would say, oh, I'll get to it later. I don't have time to read 900 pages, right? That's how the stealth attack always works, right? We'll inform our followers, but we'll obfuscate it for everyone else. So I was privileged to speak at the inaugural conference for Reverend William Barber's new Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at the Yale Divinity School. It took place over the last 2 or 3 days. It was an extraordinary event. You had several hundred faith leaders, community leaders, people from political activism, as well as journalists, coming together to talk about where this country stands at this moment in spiritual and ethical terms moving forward. And I think that the sense of crisis permeated the room. It's like, we cannot sit back and let this happen unchallenged. But when it came my time to speak, I said, well, the people who want to install an authoritarian regime have issued their blueprint, and it's Project 2025. How many of you have heard of it? And a tiny little scattering of hands went up. I said, okay, I'm going to take some of my time to tell you what's in this thing. And you need to read, if not the entire piece and synopsis, mine is one, there are other good pieces out there. But you need to know what's in it, because it is laying out the plan for taking away our freedoms and our protection for our families, our children, our communities, and even for our faith groups, because they have a very rigid concept of religion that they intend to impose on the rest of us in ways that would transform our daily lives and our interactions with our families and the world. So I think that people were receptive. And there's also a new documentary called Bad Faith, Christian Nationalism's War on Democracy, Unholy War on Democracy, that was screened at the conference that is based largely on my book. And I think the combination helped to wake people up to the dangers we face. The documentary will be available for streaming on Apple TV after April 26th. And that's another tool for people to educate themselves.
I want people to hear, here you had some of the most engaged, concerned, informed people in the United States at this event at Yale. And you asked the question about Project 2025, and only a handful of hands went up, which to me is terrifying, because if nothing else, within that group, it should have been 90%, okay? Everybody should be aware of it. And the one thing I learned from you is that this isn't a new concept out of the Heritage Foundation. They have been doing this since the 1970s, literally the 1970s. Every 4 years, they put something out. And if you look at it, every 4 years, they may not get the president they want, but they're beginning to get some of the policies they want. And they don't see losing as losing the presidency. They don't see losing as losing some of the things that they're looking for in, like, Project 2000 or Project whatever. They look at what they've won. They've looked at what they've dismantled. And so every single 4 years, they build on the winners and they reflect on the losers, and they keep expanding what they will do. And as I posted on my Facebook page the other day, I went, wait a minute, folks, fascist has already come to America. It has already come to America. Don't think you're waiting for it. It is here. And this is the most important quote, Annie, that I have. I beat the drum. I'm gonna do a sermon on it, I think. And here's what you wrote. If there's anything the past 8 years have taught us about Trump, it is that the unimaginable is too often achievable. Oh my God, that's absolutely true. We keep thinking, like, oh no, you know, it's just Trump. Oh no, it's just Trump. And I'm like, no, no, no. It is going to be our reality. And what just happened in Arizona with the Supreme Court in Arizona, that's not Trump. But that is Project 2025. What you saw with the Supreme Court in Arizona is exactly what Project 2025 wants to see happen across the United States. All right, I'll be quiet. I'm just
Don't be quiet. We cannot be quiet. And the thing about them that is actually, you know, intellectually impressive is that they have done a deep study of the actual mechanics of our government.
Yes.
Right? Not the mythology. Oh, it's a democratic country. You know, the people elect the government. No. They understand mechanics. They understand the state house. They understand the courts. They understand the electoral college. And so there are two separate silos of language about our government going on. And one is the mythology of the one man, one vote democracy. And the other is this intricate machine that is the opposite of one man, one vote. It's all the ways that electoral democracy can be overruled by tinkering with the judiciary, by tinkering with the electoral college and the state houses. And that's where they operate in the dark. So part of the problem in 2016 to 2020 is, I think a lot of us, including myself, were ambushed by what they were doing and what they had been doing. And all of a sudden they could implement it. Now, Project 2025 is the next stage, where they've already tilted the courts in their direction. They've already started operating in the state houses,
Thank
as you pointed out.
Right.
So as we learned, or we should have learned in junior high school civics class, there are three branches of government. And very rarely does one party or one movement control all three. But if they do, they can implement rapid change.
You mentioned something about the sort of the mythology of America, one man, one vote. I think the other word that I would use is we trusted the norms.
Absolutely.
And that we just thought, oh, nobody would do this. Oh, everybody believes that you should respect the outcome of an election. Oh, everyone should do this. Oh, a Supreme Court would not do that. Oh, they would never throw out Roe v. Wade. Oh my God, it's been around for 50 years. We've always expanded rights. We've never contracted rights. We've never contracted rights, everyone. And that's exactly what the Supreme Court did. We have this idea. You call it mythology. I'll call it a norm. But that means if that's how we operate under this sort of umbrella of this image, this mythology you describe, then they go exactly to where they know they can undermine it. And that is the rules, the regulations, or the failure to write rules or regulations. There are huge holes in the system where the norms have stepped in. And when you don't have a norm and you don't have a rule and you don't have a regulation, then guess what you get to do? You get to then reestablish what it is that is in that sort of vacant lot. Or frankly, you get to distort the rules and the regulations to fill in that hole. So then therefore, everything that you believed in about the courts, about the executive branch, about what would happen, it all disappears because they can manipulate everything. I always said to people, don't think that a law equals justice. That's the problem. People think that, oh man, it's the law. It must be just. No, that's not the case. More often than not, just because it's legal does not make it just. Now, that's what I've been saying. Project 2025 is about making every law and regulation unjust.
Yeah, and I think that one of the deceptive elements of this document is that there's a lot of tinkering of the mechanics of government where they'll say things that seem to make some common sense. And in fact, you know, okay, in some areas of life, there's too much regulation. There's, you know, over-regulation on whether you can have a pond next to your farmhouse, something like that. And people could read that and say, oh yeah, that's right, there's too much regulation. And then they sneak in the little landmines that transform your life and harm your children. They've also indoctrinated people through their media systems, their radio stations, their social media platforms, to make people think that all government is harmful and bad. So then they sneak in things like the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, shouldn't be able to advise children to get vaccinated to go to school. Advise children to get vaccinated, right? And if you imbue people with enough anti-vaccination hysteria, they'll read that and think it makes sense. The doctors are terrified because you have diseases, childhood diseases that are preventable by vaccinations that are breaking out already through these anti-vaccination campaigns. So it's doing direct harm. And that's what I tried to talk to people about in New Haven. It's like, no, this is not some obscure document. This is going after your children and taking away their public schools. This is going after your children and taking away public health, right? You can't sit by and let this happen.
Well, you know, what's so interesting is that, again, it's so stealth. And they want you to sort of focus over here as they're undoing everything else. And as I think about it, I think about the Mifepristone case. Everyone thinks it's about the abortion pill. No, it's not. It's about the FDA. It's not about the abortion pill. It's about, we have the strictest FDA probably in the world. In order to feel safe about a drug, it has to go through so much effort because it's about people's lives. It's about people's health being compromised. And so we have this amazing FDA that is respected around the world. And what is the Mifepristone case? It is raising questions about a decision that was made by the FDA more than 20 years ago about a drug that's safer than Tylenol. Okay. I mean, it's just, you know, something you can buy over the counter, and they're raising questions and everyone's thinking, oh, it's just another extension of the abortion conversation. Bingo. No, it's not. It's about everything the FDA does. And they want you to focus on this tiny little aspect of it when it undermines every aspect of what it is that you've learned to trust and depend on. Oh my God. And even that story hasn't been beaten enough, Anne, that people don't understand
Arnie,
so much more than Mifepristone. Yes.
they want to dismantle the ability to analyze dangers. So,
yes.
For example, most Americans don't pay much attention to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But as the granddaughter of farmers, I do. And most people don't know that the USDA helps to protect food safety.
Right.
They have scientists. They have people who analyze food. And thanks to them, we have very few outbreaks of various dangers in food that you get in other countries, right? Because they have scientists who monitor our food supply. They want to close those down, right? They want to close those down. They want to close down the scientists who analyze the dangers produced by climate and environmental dangers. They want to close down the entire departments of those agencies. It's in Project 2025, right? So all of these protections that have been painstakingly created by legislation over the years, they recruit scientists, food scientists, whose job it is to protect the public. That's over because, oh my, it might cut into a few profits here and there. A few lives may be lost, but they're disposable.
Well, and the other thing is that everyone says, well, Donald Trump is not sophisticated enough, but everyone around him is. And the beauty of Donald Trump is that he is a blank slate. Okay? Anyone can write on it. So who's writing on it? The Heritage Foundation, the Koch brothers, Stephen Miller. Understand, you don't have to listen to what he says because what he says makes no sense. I mean, look at his position on abortion. You know what I had described Donald Trump the other day? I described Donald Trump as an amoeba. He literally changes his shape based on where he is. And do you know about amoebas? Amoebas can also eat your brain. Did you know that? They do. Go read them. I said, and someone said, oh my God. I said, Donald Trump is an amoeba. And the way he is eating your brain is through lies. And the way you can't trust what he believes in policy is because it changes with the hour. But here is the most important thing. If you can't trust what's coming out of Donald Trump's mouth, then guess what, Anne? You have taught me. We have to understand what's in Project 2025. Because that is in writing. That is in detail. That points to exactly every single aspect of governing at the state, at the federal, and at the local level, and at the courts that they will dismantle. Don't listen to Trump because it changes with the hour. That document tells you exactly what they will do.
You are so right, Arnie. And, you know, you just look at Trump and, oh, yeah, 25 years ago when he was swanning around New York City, he was pro-choice, he was holding fundraisers for Planned Parenthood because that was the mood. Okay, then he suddenly says, oh, if they want me to be a born-again Christian, I can whistle that tune. And he can, you know, say whatever they script him on abortion without blinking an eye. But so if you go back in time, 30 years, as the documentary shows, Paul Weyrich, the architect of the Heritage Foundation and other organizations, put out a manifesto that really echoes Project 2025 in incredible detail. So many of the elements of this have been what they've been flogging for decades, but now they make it actionable. Now they have the authors of the chapters, people who've been inside the administration, who've been inside the Department of Education and Energy and so on, writing the details for implementation. And that's new.
And also, let's also include something else. And that is that we have the grotesque inequality. We now have more billionaires than we've ever, ever had ever in the history of the United States. You saw a number of those billionaires where? At a Trump event at Mar-a-Lago. Now, do you think they like Trump? Do you think they would let Trump take care of their children? Do you think that they would actually want to like go for a dinner with him, a real dinner that they didn't have to pay like $300,000 just to sit next to him for? No. But what they know Trump will do, well, he will enhance their wealth. He will enhance their wealth.
He already has.
Oh,
he already has. Look at his tax package in his administration.
Well, and the problem then becomes is that now you've got this enormous amount of wealth that Leonard Leo has taken advantage of, that the Heritage Foundation has taken advantage of, that Project 2025 has taken advantage of. So in an interesting way, the tax cuts are paying to bring fascism to America. Think about that. That's exactly what it is. They are swimming in so much money, okay? So much money that what it takes to buy an election, that what it takes to buy a regulation through a revolving door, that what it takes is it's pocket change. It's pocket change. And the reason they want Donald Trump elected is not that they will want to even live in his America, because they can find an island like the Cayman Islands. They can find some place to live. They don't worry about the FDA because they'll grow their own food. They'll have their own help. They'll have their own gated community. Their kids will be healthy and yours will be sick. So again, that's what's so scary, is to look at Project 2025. Look at what just happened with that huge fundraiser, $50 million he raised. $50 million. You know, and here we were like so excited about the $25 million with Joe Biden. Well, that was sort of quasi-legit, but still big checks with commas in them. This is illegit and so frightening, Ann.
And I want to point something out, which is that this same network of organizations, which I write about as with the umbrella group, the Council for National Policy, were the people who created the lawsuit for Citizens United.
Yes.
So they have been installing the building blocks for this project over many years. We have to understand that.
Absolutely. Ann Nelson, you're coming on every week. I keep telling you, you know, you can't say no. The title of her amazing piece, I will post it once again on my Facebook page. I've been doing it over and over. Project 2025, The Latest Plot Against America. Ann Nelson is the author of Shadow Network, Money, Media, and the Secret Hub of the Radical Right. She is the recipient of the Livingston Award for Journalism and a Guggenheim Fellowship for Historical Research. She just spoke at Reverend Barber's amazing conference at Yale. We are just very lucky that she says yes to me, and you are very lucky because you pay attention and take notes. This, everyone, is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy. We will be right back.
This Civil Liberties Minute is about school dress codes, racism, and conformity. I'm Bill Newman. Texas, like about half the states, has a Crown Act. Crown, creating a respectful and open world for natural hair, a Texas law that prohibits discrimination based on hair texture or protective hairstyle commonly or historically associated with race. But the law hasn't protected 18-year-old Daryl George, who has locks, rope-like strands that he pins on his head in a barrel roll, a protective hairstyle that reflects Black culture. Notwithstanding the Crown Act, the dress code in Daryl's high school in Mont Belvieu, Texas, prohibits hair that could extend beyond the top of a t-shirt collar. The fact that Daryl has never let his hair down in school was irrelevant. And recently, the state district court judge hearing the case agreed, ruling that because the Crown Act doesn't specifically mention hair length, the school could legally discipline Daryl as it has, including suspensions and relegating him to an off-campus disciplinary program, because he wouldn't cut off his locks. What lesson should we learn from this school dispute? Well, the superintendent once explained his view that, quote, being an American requires conformity. There's another significant claim in the related federal case. Because the dress code targets Black male students, it violates federal civil rights law. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom.
2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do
when the time to act is now. And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Dave Scott and Fred Portnoy, who's replacing Stephanie Collins. As you know, we record on Wednesday morning. Well, I was kidding, folks, that we should be calling this the Washington Spectator Hour, because both my guests, one, have been on with me before. I was so wildly impressed with them and what they wrote, I had to bring them back. We started with Annie Nelson, who was talking about Project 2025, the latest plot against America. And she is going to be coming on with me virtually every week and between now and the election, because I want you to know everything about this 900-page tome. It really is about an assault on American democracy and about the installation of fascism. But we also had a wonderful opportunity to interview Mark Medish and Joe McCleary. They had written an article that was entitled Dancing in the Dark, and it came in two parts. I've invited them back for part two, which is Dancing in the Dark, the Paradoxical Risk of Senate Filibuster Reform. Their first part was really looking at what could possibly happen between the election and the inauguration. And both pieces are like absolutely important for you to be aware of. They both fit together like pieces in a puzzle. I'm going to ask them to sort of quickly reflect on what part one was about in case you missed it, because we can't repeat it often enough. And then I want them to get into this part two, which is about the risk of a Senate filibuster. And Mark Medish is a lawyer. He served as a special assistant to the president and senior director of the National Security Council, as well as deputy assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury in the Clinton administration. Joe McCleary served as the deputy assistant of the president in the Carter administration, which means that they are very much steeped in the federal government, especially to a large extent in the executive branch. And I so value what you wrote, because it was both shocking. And one of the things I talked about, Mark and Joel, with Annie, was that we are so dependent of not having to know what the rules and the regulations are. We depend on what we call norms. Oh, of course they would reflect the will of the people. Oh, of course, one man, one vote. Of course there's, you know, this could happen or that can happen. And a lot of it just assumes that people will abide by the intent, maybe, of the rule of the regulation, not necessarily with the precise language of it, or that there is a rule or regulation. We find out there is none, and therefore they can fill the void. And so we've been so dependent on people sort of playing nice in the sandbox. And then we got Trump. And Trump doesn't believe in sandboxes, but he believes in himself. And he believes in authoritarianism, and he believes in fascism. And now he has surrounded himself with people that agree with them, because they too want to take over the government. Project 2025 describes in detail what they will do. But you do something, I think, more important, because even if we win an election, we may not win. And I think that that's so, so important, because again, the norm is, well, you got the most votes, or you got enough votes in the Electoral College. Of course you could become president, but you pointed out in your first piece that may not be the case. And then in your second piece, you sort of add to that fear. So I'm going to start with you, Mark, and ask you to talk a little bit about the first part of your piece, Dancing in the Dark. Describe to my audience once again what you were looking at between Election Day and the inauguration, because I think people need to understand there are so many places where damage can be done.
Arnie, thank you so much for having us on. It's a real honor, and thank you for all the work you're doing in terms of raising consciousness about democracy at risk. It's essential work. Joel and I have been writing a series of articles under the rubric Dancing in the Dark, thanks to Bruce Springsteen. What we've been trying to look at is exactly what you're talking about, that we're in an out-of-the-sandbox situation. One of the great strengths of America has been we could, you know, usually broadly rely on our institutions, on popular trust in the system, that we knew how to conduct elections. And we would respect the results. Unfortunately, since January 6th and even before that, it's been very clear that former President Trump and people around him are really interested in gaining power by almost whatever means they can. And so what Joel and I have done in these pieces is to look at how you could get there in an out-of-the-sandbox situation, when the rules are broken, not followed, or bent. The first piece was about risks in the House of Representatives, how power plays using parliamentary procedures could enable essentially a constitutional coup by manipulating certification of House seats and thereby the majority in the new House, and by maybe impeding the Electoral College from being certified on January 6th, and basically creating a situation of chaos. The second piece shifts to the Senate and looks at where are the potential abuses of power, procedural power, in the Senate, and specifically around the question of filibuster and when you can take a bill to a vote.
I've always rolled my eyes at the filibuster. And then I read your piece. And you know, everything isn't all good and everything isn't all bad. But there was something in your piece, Mark and Joel, that made me realize that I've actually embraced this concept as well. And you talk about something that we call situational ethics, that there may be a time, and this may be the time, where the filibuster may be essential to save democracy. We may not like it because it's not ruled by the majority. You need 60% vote to get anything through, and we're so ticked off. We get 58, we get 57. How do we get to 60? I mean, it's just so many good pieces of policy we've seen like lay on the floor because we couldn't get to that 60%. But I want to just share my personal involvement with situational ethics, because until I read your piece, I didn't realize I have actually done the same thing. So I wrote a piece at The Nation magazine begging Joe Biden not to run back in 2023, in early 2023. I said he wasn't ready for the moment. I said the moment is very frightening. He doesn't have the level of enthusiasm for the moment. And I just don't think he can deliver the message that we need, because we're living on a precipice. And I'm not sure that not only that he may appreciate that precipice, but I'm not sure he's able to deliver the message in a way that people can hear it, okay? And it wasn't just about age. And then I was really angry, but not angry, not surprised. I've always thought that New Hampshire should not be the first in the nation presidential primary. I'll be honest with you, that we shouldn't be these prima donnas. And I love it. I've known every presidential candidate on both sides of the aisle. I'm privileged to have done it. And I am in awe of what I've been able to do, but I also realize it's probably not fair. But let me talk about situational ethics. This was not the year for Joe Biden and the Democratic Party to move the New Hampshire presidential primary. Move it 4 years from now. But because we are talking about a reelect with Donald Trump and Joe Biden, because of the toxicity of the moment, because of what we needed to do, it was the stupidest decision to move it to South Carolina. You can move it 4 years from now. I don't want to own it. But again, it's the idea of look at the moment we are in. Look at the situation we are in. You blew it. You blew it. And everyone knows Arnie's not a happy camper about the New Hampshire primary. So to hear Arnie say, not this time, means that I appreciate not only what is right, sort of on a broad scale, but given the situation, what is right is different. What is right is different. And that's why, Joel, I want you to talk a little bit about the sort of the agonizing you go through by describing the positives and negatives about a filibuster. And yet by the end of this article that you've written, Dancing in the Dark, you are grateful that the filibuster actually exists, because if everything falls apart in the House, it may be the Senate that is our place of last resort. And it turns out that this thing that we see is somewhat undemocratic, i.e. the 60% is supermajority, may be the only thing that saves us. So Joel, explain to us a little bit about this sort of discussion of the filibuster that you go into tremendous detail, giving us both sides of the discussion, but also reminding us that we're not talking about something generic, we're talking about a particular moment.
Let me start off by giving you another example of situation ethics. Most people are against giving a president a lot of emergency powers when they're out of power. Yes. But then as soon as you get in power, suddenly you understand the use of emergency powers. And of course, you think you're ethical and you think that, you know, you can handle this. So this happens on many different issues. In terms of our particular concern about the filibuster, is you use the term the majority. Well, what do we really mean? Are we talking about a majority of the American voters, a majority of the American populace? Or what do we, I mean, as we know, having two senators per state, where Rhode Island has the, you know, same power in the Senate as California does, so what we're really up against here is the possibility of a very well-mobilized minority seizing the power that they need in the Senate to move an agenda that really is not supported by the majority.
Right.
And that's what makes us nervous. What also makes us nervous is in his first term, Trump won and was rather surprised by it and wasn't ready to govern. The reason that you're talking with Anne and others is they're ready this time. They know that they lost the presidency by not by winning the election, but not what we, Mark and I, call winning the coup, and that is taking the reins of the government so that you can move. They are going to be ready as much as any presidential team has been ready that we know of in modern history. So that's what we're worried about, is if there is a if Trump does take power in January of 25, they will probably move very, very quickly to pass an ominous MAGA bill that will have all the things that they want to get done early on. And to do that, they would probably want just a simple majority to be able to pass it. And that's where there'd be a lot of pressure on all the members to get rid of the filibuster in order to pass this historic moment. It'd be like, as Mark has talked about, it'd be like what Franklin Roosevelt did from the left's point of view when he came to power, in passing major pieces of legislation to get the country back on track again. That's how the right sees this moment. This is their historic moment to reverse what Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson had done and to right the ship.
I know about the filibuster, but I know that there's been at least two times that we've been able to get beyond the filibuster, and it's called the nuclear option. So when is a filibuster not a filibuster? When do you get a nuclear option and not get a nuclear option? And why do you think the filibuster in place will protect us if there is this way around the filibuster called the nuclear option? So I keep thinking, okay, I want to embrace the filibuster. But wait a minute, we've not embraced it these two times. If Donald Trump is successful and he knows exactly what it is he's going to do, he knows exactly how to get around the filibuster. So what's going to protect me from the nuclear option than basically shoving all the crap down our throats because they will get everything they want in that omnibus bill? I'm just trying to figure out, again, I don't know all the nuances of what it is they have to do, because this is so sophisticated and over my pay grade, but I need to actually up my pay grade so I understand this. And I'm just trying to figure out, when is a filibuster not a filibuster? Because that scares me too.
Well, it's probably over all of our pay grades, but we think we need to pay attention to it. It's very arcane. It has to do with parliamentary procedural rules.
Okay.
So as you know, the filibuster, as it stands now, is basically ends up requiring 60 votes to stop debate on a bill before it can be taken to a floor vote for a decision.
Right.
There are exceptions that are already kind of built in, particularly around budget reconciliation and trade deals. There's been an agreement in Congress that those should move forward faster. And then, as you pointed out, a nuclear option was also developed, which was a sneaky way to change the 60 rule with a simple majority vote. And that's the nuclear option, which was pioneered by late Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid over judicial nominations. And he did this after Obama suffered setbacks in the midterm elections in 2012.
Okay.
And there was a sense that the whole agenda was grinding to a halt. And so Reid goes forward with this. So is it actually Democrats who put this forward? And it goes to Joel's point that the shoe can be on the other foot. That's our main argument here. So be careful what you wish for. What's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander.
And I know that there have been two times that they've used the nuclear option.
Yeah.
And again, if there is a back door, that back door with Donald Trump and his minions becomes the front door. As soon as I heard and I thought about the nuclear option, I'm like, this is not good. And in addition to which, what else I learned in your article, and of course I sort of knew this, these are about sort of the rules of the Senate. And the rules of the Senate are their rules. So that means you can't appeal to a court. You can't
beyond,
I mean, this is all sort of internal, playing. And it's our rules. I get to decide what you wear and what you do and what you show up. It's about how we operate, and therefore it's only about us. It's not about the sort of the bigger, broader picture, although it does impact the bigger, broader picture. That's what's so scary too, is that they control their destiny and they control how they play the game. So what I'm frightened about is that you embrace the filibuster as something that might ultimately protect us from Donald Trump. But knowing from this Project 2025 that some of the most brilliant people know how to dismantle everything, everything. And what makes me think that the nuclear option doesn't become their preferred choice?
Well, there's a real risk. There's a real risk of that. There's no perfect protection here. But so what we're trying to do is alert folks that, look, the Senate, like the House, these are political bodies and majorities matter. Majorities really get to run the show. So that's the point. And there are these instances of majority power plays that bend rules. So what we're appealing to is actually bipartisan crossovers, that what will become essential is individual. Let's say the Republicans get a majority in the next Senate. The key will be, will there be individual crossovers that out of conscience and prudence cross over to block an attempt to do the nuclear option on the filibuster? That's where the hope lies. And we've seen some of this already, right? With McCarthy Romney in the House, there were crossovers on the budget deal. You know, this is what we're appealing to. So there are key independent-minded senators who hold the key to this, to maintaining this protection, this check and balance. But you're absolutely right. There's no perfect guarantee.
No, so Joel, I love you, Mark, but I don't know what you're smoking, because as I'm looking at the difference in the people that are either leaving the Senate or running for the Senate, if Republicans are successful, by definition, they have no idea what across the aisle means. They have no idea. This is what the MAGA Republicans, Joel, have created. They have created a cult-like command and control following that doesn't allow the elected official to do anything that requires a conscience. We've seen it in the past where people have crossed the aisle, but that is becoming more and more difficult and more challenging. The only thing, Joel, that I think is important as I'm looking at your description of the filibuster and what needs to be maintained is that now with what's going on with abortion is really going to be interesting, because the Senate is about a statewide election. It is not about a gerrymandered election. It is about a statewide election. And that to some extent could be the gift. We keep thinking that we might lose, that the Republicans might lose the House. I am going to tell you, after watching what just happened in Arizona, with the Supreme Court in Arizona, they are so insane. They are so out to harm half the population. They're going to such a level of extremism that all of a sudden now, what should be a Senate race based on a lot of things is now going to be a Senate race that really is going to look at abortion in a very, very, very different way, because it is war. It is not just war on women. It is war on rights. It's war on so many things. So I guess, Joel, as I'm reading this, I am so afraid of the nuclear option. I'm so afraid of the filibuster, but I don't think that we have the capacity to see a lot of senators that will cross the aisle. But I do think now if we read this, suddenly who you elect a senator has a million times more meaning than before they read your article.
I think that's true. It's interesting. Let's just go back to what the nuclear option did. We wouldn't have the Supreme Court, those three conservative judges that were appointed by Trump. They got 52, 54. None of them got 60 votes.
Yeah.
So if the nuclear option hadn't been there, we would have a much more mainstream Supreme Court as we talk right now. And of course, as Mark points out, this is something that the Democrats put forward at first for all the right reasons, but then look at what the consequence was. In terms of what's ahead, remember for Trump and a lot of his folks, this is the jailhouse of the White House. All rules are out the door.
Yeah, he and Bibi Netanyahu. Keep going.
And so we, as Mark said at the beginning, there are no norms here as we go into this election. And we can take no, maybe we're going to have a good couple of days here. Maybe it will look like we move ahead in the polls. Maybe God knows what. But, you know, there are external events that can happen. There are terrorist events that can happen. They're all this is going to be a very unstable situation all the way to probably January 25th. So there is no, we need to be totally prepared on every single level, and we need to think through every single possible option of what can unfold.
Yeah, it's I'm telling you, Mark, as I wake up in the morning and I keep thinking about, how can someone say, I don't have a choice in November? How can they say that? Because what we are looking at is so, I mean, and you're absolutely right, Joel, that the problem with Donald Trump is that this is not just about power. This is about an orange jumpsuit. Let's understand this. This isn't about whether he's a billionaire or not. This isn't about the value of Mar-a-Lago or how many golf tournaments he has or, you know, whatever. This is literally about something he has never had to confront. And what he's never had to confront is jail is not a healthy place. And for someone like,
it's not just for him. I mean, now they're saying it's going to be for Biden. It's going to probably be for Obama, for Bush. I mean, it's on the, everybody's talking about putting the other side in jail now. We've never had this situation.
Actually, Joel, that's an amazing point. Mark, I keep thinking about the choice for Donald Trump is the choice between freedom and jail. But if Trump wins, the choice for Biden and for Biden's son and for Kamala Harris and for whomever is again the choice between freedom. I mean, I'll be kidding you. He also talks about the media and who in the media he will arrest. And so I've been measuring myself for orange jumpsuits. Yeah. I mean, I'm not being funny, Mark. I literally am saying, am I prepared to go to jail? No, but understand I am exactly the kind of person that they would want to see because they would want to shut me down. You know, you don't need to have a big mouth. You just need to have a mouth, Mark. And if the mouth doesn't follow what's in Project 2025, then you are vulnerable.
But if I don't understand those states, that's the problem, Arnie.
Yeah. Right. Mark?
But it still, you know, comes down to, it can come down to individual senators. We remember the famous moment when John McCain did the thumbs down on the attempt to repeal Obamacare. Yes. His vote singularly mattered, uniquely mattered at that moment. That happened to be in a reconciliation process where only a simple majority was needed, but that vote was essential. So too, actually, for passage of the Affordable Care Act, originally, as you recall, Ted Kennedy had passed away. He was replaced by a Republican who ultimately came along with the program.
Brown.
One vote can matter a hell of a lot. And so that's why we make an appeal to conscience and prudence. And about ethics, situation ethics. Ethics, morality is about principles fundamentally, but it's also about consequences. What good are principles if you end up destroying the whole system? That's our point. So there's no reason to have a bad feeling about being prudent on filibuster reform. There are powerful, powerful arguments for filibuster reform. Joel and I would agree with them. We would prefer a majoritarian system. But in this situation, with the choice that you described, Arnie, and the potential for authoritarianism, we need to shore up every check and balance that's available.
I've been giving a lot of graduation speeches over the course of my long life. I always quote Calvin Coolidge. And why do I quote Calvin Coolidge? Because Calvin Coolidge had a great definition of patriotism. And what he said was, patriotism means looking after yourself by looking after your country. And the reason why I love that, it's kind of a variation on situational ethics. He starts with the selfish piece, okay? That you are always looking at, oh, look at the price of eggs. Oh, look at the price of gas. Oh, I can't afford a place to live. Oh, all these things. And that's very much intimate with you. You see the consequences of what that means for your family and for your life. But this election is so much bigger than what the price of eggs is. It's so much bigger than what it is really about whether we have a future. I really see this as a life and death choice. I really, really do. And it's not about whether, you know, Donald Trump wins and Arnie gets fingered by his cops. It's about whether we have an imperfect democracy or fascism. That's really what the choice is. And trust me, I can tell you a lot of things wrong with this democracy. I'm the consequence of that. I have lost because of this imperfect democracy. But that doesn't mean I throw it away. you know, and that means I fight for it. And so again, I'm going to encourage people to read this, again, two-part series, Dancing in the Dark. It's been written by Mark Medish, a lawyer who served with in the Clinton administration, and also with Joel McCleary, who served in the Carter administration. And I want to thank both of you for writing this, and keep writing and keep calling me. We'll get this on. I want people to hear it. I want them to process it, and I want them to understand the consequences of November. So again, thank you so much for doing this.
And we'll get you a very good orange suit. We'll get the best.
Okay, God, please, please. Listen. I wear a small size, like size 2, size 4. Anyway, this is the Thursday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producer Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow, everyone. Ciao.